Welcome to the South Platte River Committee of Denver City Council. This session of the South Platte River Committee begins now.
Good afternoon, everyone. There we go. Good afternoon. Welcome to the South Platte River Committee on July 9th. I'm Councilwoman Torres. I'm proud to represent West Denver District 3 and chair of this committee. So thank you all for joining us. We've got a great briefing today from Metro Water Recovery. Thank you for being here. But let's do some council member introductions before we turn it over to our speaker. And I'll start to my left.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Daryl Watson, representing Defiant District 9.
And Councilwoman Alvitres with Lucky District 7.
Good afternoon. Stacey Gilmore, District 11.
Thank you so much. And do we have anyone online? Okay. We'll turn it right over to our presenter. Thank you so much for being here, Mickey. Go ahead and introduce yourself and take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Mickey Conway, the CEO of Metro Water Recovery here in Denver, Colorado. And I want to thank the council for the committee for inviting me. We always like to go out and talk about wastewater and clean water, protecting our environment and the public. So I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much. What we want to do today is talk a little bit about what we do, our partnership with the City, County, and Denver and 65 other entities protecting the region, and some opportunities we have in the future to make sure that we're keeping our river clean and our public safe. So please stop me if you have questions at any point.
We'll hold questions to the end.
Okay, that's great. So our mission is to protect the region's health and environment by cleaning water and recovering resources. And our tagline that we put together a couple years ago is, we get your water. And that's kind of a cheeky two-way meaning there. One is that we literally receive all the water that's pretty much all the water that's used in the metro area, used in homes and sinks, toilets, showers, whatever you use in your home, businesses, you know, industrial establishments, restaurants, commercial establishments, that comes to us through local systems, goes to our larger interceptor pipes, and then we clean that water, remove resources from it, and put the water back into our beloved South Platte River. And so we get literally receive the water. That's part of it. The other part of it is that we have employees who have been dedicated to this craft, many of whom have done this their entire career. They are community members. They care about what they do. They are passionate about protecting the environment and passionate about protecting our local communities, and they get it. They understand it. We are award-winning in terms of national, international awards, one of the most innovative treatment facilities in the world, and all of that redounds to the benefit of our ratepayers. So we not only receive your water, but we get it. So this slide here gives you a little bit of the scope of, first of all, I forgot to introduce Erin Bertoli, who's our government affairs officer, liaison here. She will correct me if I get anything wrong, which will probably happen. But Erin is a valuable asset for us and works with all of our local governments. So this is our service area, which is about 850 square miles of the metro area. It includes, as far north as Fort Lupton, west all the way to the foothills, east as far east as Aurora goes, which is apparently endless, and down to the south, almost past Centennial at some spots. About 65 local governments are our partners that make up Metro. That serves about 2.2 million people in Colorado, about 40% of our population. That produces about 140 million gallons of wastewater every single day that comes to our facilities. And we invest on behalf of all of our partners billions and billions of dollars to do this work, but it has resulted in a much cleaner river and a much safer environment for our constituents. The way Metro is governed, our makeup is essentially a partnership. That's what we are. We're a partnership of 65 local either water and sand districts or cities. And the partners work together to ensure regional protections. We're protecting the entire region together. 23 of those 65 are what we call member municipalities. Denver, Aurora, Lakewood, Thornton, Arvada. They're usually the larger cities in our service area, and those member municipalities appoint board members, and we have 40 board members, so I have 40 bosses, but I have a great relationship with all of them, and it works very well because our board really thinks regionally when they make decisions, And those board members are appointed by population. So Denver has 10 board seats, which weighs out, it says approximately 40. It's about mid-30s in terms of percentage on the vote, which corresponds approximately with Denver's flow that they contribute to the to Metro. Our board votes on the big stuff, budget, our rates, capital projects, large expenditures, policy issues. And then we as staff execute, you know, the directives from the board. And I noted that the board is has a regional focus. I think this is a really important aspect of what we do. Metro was created, actually people in the city and county of Denver were the ones who started it with a number of communities surrounding Denver about 60 years ago because it was easier and better and more efficient to do this work together than to do it separately all over the region. And that has resulted in some cost efficiencies and incredible improvements in our water quality and our environment. And it's really a regional dedication that was envisioned by what we call the Founding Fathers back in the 50s that has seen through today. And an example is we have large projects that will benefit one part of Metro's service area, but maybe not another. But the board votes for that regionally. An example is our South Platte Interceptor, which benefits Aurora, Denver, the airport, Fort Lupton, and South Adams. The entire board voted for that project. Even though the west side and south side wasn't getting a direct benefit, it was a regional benefit. And so we do that all the time, and it's really a great way to look at infrastructure and funding for public health. So this is a slide that just talks about sort of how this works, like how the process works. And I would invite you to come to our plant and see it. It is, as I said, one of the most technologically advanced treatment plants in the country, if not the world. We have some of the smartest people in the industry running this place, and it's really exciting. It doesn't sound like exciting, but it's very exciting to come see. It's high-level technology, and it's incredibly high-performing. Basically, the way it works is that all that wastewater goes into a system that's locally owned, like City and County of Denver's or Avada system, comes to our larger, what we call interceptor pipes. Those take the water to one of our two treatment plants. One's in Commerce City, right on the border of Denver, actually, and the other's in Brighton. And all that water moves by gravity, with the exception of just a couple segments of our system, which is really sustainable, which doesn't require greenhouse gas burning energy use. It's very, just traditionally using what we've got in terms of gravity. And then once it comes to the plants, it goes through this process we outline here. At the beginning, we remove stuff like trash and things that shouldn't be in the sewer in the first place, or things that might hurt our downstream apparatus. And then all of that water moves into what we call primary clarification. These are big round tanks where solids settle to the bottom and liquids stay on the top. At that point, and you'll see a black line going from primary clarification, we have two streams that we deal with, liquid and solid. And the liquid stream moves into what we call BNR, which is biological nutrient removal. And that's where microorganisms interact with the water and eat the phosphorus and nitrogen and the bad stuff in the water. And they literally consume it. And it mimics what a river does naturally in cleaning water. And this has been a technology that's been around essentially since the Phoenicians, but we have really tuned it to a very high degree of success. So it goes through BNR, and then it goes into what's called secondary clarification, another tank to settle any remaining solids. And then goes out to disinfection, and the disinfection process is required to remove things like E. coli. And so we have a very high level of disinfection that results in water that goes back into the South Platte River every day. About 140 million gallons go back into our wonderful river, and that water is cleaner than the river's water itself. It is cleaner in virtually all respects. Certainly E. coli and these nutrients the effluent is very clean. It's clean per standards that CDPHE sets that are very, very stringent. And our performance on that is pretty much nonstop. We have to comply with that 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and we do. So we're putting that water back into the river. An interesting facet of this is that just upstream of Metro's facility in Commerce City, and it's basically between 58th and 64th in York, the ditch companies sweep the river water, and there's very little river water in the winter, especially between where the ditch companies sweep the Burlington Ditch and where we put the water back in. So Metro basically replenishes the entire river. 85, 90, and in winter, more than 90% of the river comes from basically all the water that we all use goes back into the river. And so we are reestablishing that river there. And that's why the effluent limitations are so strict, because it's basically clean river water going back in. So that's how the liquid side works. The solids, of which we produce 95 tons a day, go through a process called digestion, and that's where they're heated up in an anaerobic or non-oxygen setting, and they are basically cleaned that way, and they produce methane. All solid waste like this will produce methane, and that methane, though, we're not releasing in the air. We capture it and convert it to electricity. It powers 40% of our operations, and as you can imagine, our operations are very heavily dependent on electricity, so this is a great savings in terms of sustainability, basically a biofuel that's reusable, and also saving our ratepayers quite a bit of money. So we do that, and then we dewater those solids, get some of the water out of them, and we take them out as a soil amendment to farms in the Eastern Plains. And we have a number of farmers who are asking for this product. The list is a mile long, and we serve those farmers for soil amendment, and then we also put some of these biosolids on our own 52,000-acre farm that we have out in Deer Trail, Colorado, just a couple, about an hour east of our facility. So that's how it works. 150 million gallons a day going into the river, 100 tons basically of solids every day. It never stops coming. It's the same, basically the same every day, unless we get maybe the Super Bowl, we get a little more. Kind of there's strange days that seem to line up with more flow, but that happens no matter what we do. So as you can imagine, this costs a lot of money, and obviously that's foremost on the minds of our board members and the people who pay our rates. Kind of a big picture breakdown of what we pay for in a given year. These are 2024 figures on here. The operating budget, which is what it takes to run the plant and the associated work that we do in the plant, it's about 42%. That was $134 million in 24. The capital expenditures, things we have to build in order to keep up with our regulatory requirements, things we have to build to keep up with asset replacement, about $131 million. So those are both roughly around a little more than 40%. And then we have debt service at about 17%. That's $52 million. We are able to go out in the bond market and get very favorable rates, so we can borrow money to kind of spread that cost out in, for our future users as well. That little thing down in the corner there is one that's changing constantly. That's our anticipated capital expenditures. Right now it's looking like about $1.3 billion over the next 10 years. That is likely low because of regulatory things that we're looking at. It's likely going to be a lot higher than that. So we're always planning and we're always building to make sure we can stay ahead of what the regulators need us to do. And so that's kind of the theme of this slide, is what drives all these costs. So the first and foremost are regulatory requirements. So the EPA sets water quality, sets up a water quality regime that the CDPHE implements in Colorado, and ensures that anyone discharging into that water is discharging very clean effluent that's going to not disturb the water quality standards in our streams. So CDPHE has very strict permits for us that we have been complying with on a regular basis for many years. Not surprisingly, those standards change over time, and they don't get looser, they get tighter. And CDPHE's current regulatory scheme is contemplating increasingly strict limits, including some of the strictest and lowest limits for phosphorus and nitrogen in the country. That is in part because that stream is coming all out of our mostly just wastewater dischargers or other dischargers that, you know, have permits. And the other thing is that you know, that water driving out there is there's not a lot of it. And so if we had a huge flowing river like you have in Memphis or in the Mississippi or the Missouri River, you know, you can get away with dilution. Here we have no dilution. So we have to ensure that this water is very, very clean. And the cost of maintaining clean water is extraordinary. And you've probably heard this in other you know, in other venues, and when it comes to achieving regulatory compliance, the first 90% costs, you know, 20, 30% of the overall cost. The last 10 costs 70%. It is extremely expensive to get to super low limits. It's a very energy intensive use. Unfortunately, most of these things are burning greenhouse gases one way or another if we're getting them from the power company or wherever we get our power. So we try to be as judicious as we can with what we do in terms of energy expenditure and chemical expenditure. So those are things that are driving costs significantly. The second thing is asset replacement. We have a 60-year-old plus system. Obviously, some of those assets are aging. Many of them are. We try to keep a schedule that balances the cost to our ratepayers with the safety to our ratepayers, you know, in mind. We do not want pipes breaking in our streets. We have not had pipes breaking in our streets, so we're very fortunate there. That's our number one priority, is to not have sanitary sewer overflows in our neighborhoods, and we do not, in at least in the metro system itself. That's very, very, very rare. Our assets on the plant side are also aging. We have a secondary process that we're replacing right now that's from the 1960s, and that takes, there's a lot of cost in replacing those systems. The other two costs I just noted on here, everybody kind of knows about this. The cost of labor has gone up pretty significantly. I think in many ways a benefit, because we have people who work for us and they need a living wage. And I'm glad to see that we're able to pay them that. But the costs of construction itself have outpaced inflation pretty significantly, especially and including the cost of highly technical equipment that we use, like things that we get in terms of electrical service delivery, highly functioning pumps. Those types of things have gone up, and the tariffs, and I'm not here to comment on where we are with tariffs, but it seems like we're somewhere every day a little differently, are going to have a huge effect on it. That equipment is very expensive and will be more expensive. That is a huge driver of these costs. And then I noted chemical and power costs. Those are things, we need chemicals to operate these systems. We need power, and those costs are, out of our control for the most part. We do a lot of ratcheting down in terms of how we can use less energy and how we can use less chemical, but at some point there's a baseline we've got to use. So that's what's driving our ratepayers' bills. And the way we pay for that, we have three revenue streams. One we call annual charges, and those are the fees we pay for the operation of the system, and all of our connectors pay that. The annual charge fee was about $155 million in 2024, and about $57 million of that, a little more than a third, which matches up to about Denver's flow, was paid by Denver, City and County of Denver. That is just the cost of operating the system. The second revenue stream is what we call sewer connection charges, and those are when we have new connections into the system. We have a connection charge that is paid for by our members. The members then can go out and charge their local constituents what they want in terms of the connection charge. But that's based on the fact that people throughout time have invested in the system, and new users should, ante into the investment that everyone else has made. That's about 25% of our annual revenue. It's about almost $60 million in 2024. About 19 of that came from Denver. And the third element here is what we call interest in other sources, smaller amounts of money that come in from products that we develop, where we pull resources out of our system, credits we've gotten for environmental work that we've done, sale of our biosolids, minimal amounts, but still, 3% of a lot of money is still a significant amount. The other thing that's not on here that is really a revenue source is our bond funding. And so if we want to go out and we're looking at next year probably for another bond, floating another bond, we go do that, and then that gets spread out over time. So it could, kind of limits the impact on the current ratepayers. So the big thing that we are kind of known for, and I think that is the biggest benefit to our ratepayers, has a direct impact on cost, is innovation. Metro is known, and I am proud of this, as one of the, if not the most innovative wastewater treatment plants, clean water facilities in the country, and one of the most innovative in the world. We try to find ways to save on infrastructure costs, save on energy use, save on chemical use, save on impact to our communities, knowing that we still have to get to the same end result regardless. So one of the things we've done in the phosphorus realm is phosphorus is obviously something that's very damaging to waterways. It's very important to remove that from the water stream. It's very expensive to do that. And we have found ways to do that that are actually, paying off, that are very, very innovative. But one of it is called MagPrex, which is a phosphorus recovery reactor. And we literally run the flow through this. It precipitates a reaction that creates something called struvite, which is a phosphorus, like a crystallized phosphorus. We're able to pull that out of the stream and turn it into basically a fertilizer. And now that fertilizer can be used either in compost or for farming. It's perfectly pure phosphorus. There's nothing in it, no other chemical composite. It's a really great win-win in terms of sustainability. Makes the river cleaner, saves on costs, and it ultimately produces a product that can be sustainably reused. Another very interesting resource recovery issue is heat. So wastewater has heat in it. And it has heat in it because we heat it up because of dishwashers and sinks, hot water that you use in your shower. And that water goes into the pipes and travels to the wastewater treatment facilities. And it's still just about as hot as it was when it left your house. It's really interesting. Now, of course, it merges with cold water and balances a little bit. But that heat is an available source of thermal energy that is just going out into the river. And CDPHE would like us to cool off that water that's going into the river, which is a noble cause, but it is, as you can imagine, under traditional technologies, extremely expensive. We would essentially have to refrigerate all the water in the Front Range. The amount of electricity alone that would go into doing that is absolutely staggering. The greenhouse gas associations with that production of electricity, the air emissions associated with that production of electricity, they don't seem to align with our value of protecting the public. We want to protect the river and the public. So what we have been doing is developing ways to extract the heat from the system before it goes into the river. One of the places we've done that is the district energy system at the National Western. It's a small kind of pilot project for us. It literally takes heat through a heat exchanger out of the sewer system, puts it into a district heating loop, cold water chilled heating loop, heats and cools a big chunk of National Western's campus. We are now working with City and County of Denver to consider doing this at a much larger scale downtown, especially with the opportunities we have with the loop downtown. We're working also with Excel, we're working with Ball Arena, we're working with River Mile. We could offload all of this heat and heat and cool downtown Denver sustainably, perfect heat that we were just wasting, in a win-win for everybody. It's a huge lift. It would be the biggest system of its kind in the world. But it's the kind of thing that we want to do, that we think that the City and County of Denver leads on in terms of sustainability, in terms of thinking about the future. This is exactly the kind of project that the mayor's vision, that the council's vision, that the city's vision has been for a while, I think aligns with perfectly. So we're very, very excited about this. It's going to take a lot of work and a lot of collaboration, but I believe it can be done. So what do we have ahead of us? This is the fun stuff that keeps us up at night, but we also really enjoy thinking about. One is regulatory unpredictability. Part of that is things that you hear about in the news, like PFAS. Chemicals that are being introduced into our water systems that are not created by the water providers. Denver Water doesn't create PFAS. Aurora Water doesn't create PFAS. That's created by manufacturing companies who put it on to products or in products. That all ends up at the sewer plant. And we are not constructed to remove PFAS. We are constructed to deal with domestic waste. So an investment to get to a place where we're extracting PFAS is a ways away, but we're working on the technology associated with that. But what we would like to stress first is to take it out of the system before it even gets in the water system. Take it out of products. Take it out of commerce. What we are seeing is not that we are getting PFAS from industrial installations. We are getting it from us. Mm-hmm. It's coming from regular people, the products that we use. That's probably 75 plus 80% of the PFAS we're getting is just coming from homes. And so it's very difficult for us to go into a home and say, don't use PFAS, where I can go into an industrial facility and say, you got to stop. I can't govern what people do in their homes. So as much support as we can get for taking this bad stuff out of commerce and taking it out of products will benefit all of us in the long run, because the cost associated with us removing something like PFAS is in the billions of dollars. In addition to PFAS, there are a bunch of new things that we keep tab of. There's like a new PFAS every 6 months that you hear about in our world, and you will all be hearing about it soon. All kinds of chemicals that we are starting to be able to detect that we couldn't even detect previously. So it is a big, big undertaking for our sector to try to stay ahead of this stuff. But it's something we are absolutely dedicated to, and the people with whom I work are crazy about doing, because they want to protect their communities. These other challenges that have gotten here are all things that you hear about all the time. This aging infrastructure issue is City and County of Denver has it. The counties around us have it. The cities have it. We have it. Investment in infrastructure is something that has to happen. Otherwise, bad things happen. We want to avoid that, certainly. Workforce, huge issue for us. We have blue-collar jobs mainly where we work, and it's becoming harder to find truck drivers and mechanics and people who want to run machinery. We have programs that we're going out to high schools. We're going out even the junior highs, trying to get people excited about careers in water. It's a great career. You can make a living here, take care of a family, do exciting work that includes technical applications. It's just getting to that connection with people who you know, a lot of these kids, they want to be video game designers or whatever it is they want to do. Just saying, hey, this is kind of like that, but you're actually protecting your community at the same time. And then, you know, just general cost of business we've talked about. It's just something that we're always really, really laser focused on and trying to keep on top of. But it's something that the cost of water has not been appropriately valued in our communities. There are things that we're spending money on that are not only are they not saving lives, they're causing health problems. And we are pushing the water sector into a place where we're saying we don't want to spend as much money on water. Personally, I think that's a big mistake. This stuff costs a lot of money, and it's absolutely essential to do. If we stop doing our work, yeah, it would be over in a couple of days here. So that we never want that to happen, never want that to come close to happening. And so we want to just keep reminding people that our costs, which are far lower than national averages, are controllable mostly because our communities have continued to make investment. As long as we keep doing that, we will be able to have lower than average national costs and produce really high quality effluent. So the last little slide here, this is a slide that we work with the City and County of Denver, with Denver Water and what we call One Water. This is applicable not just with those entities in Mile High Flood District, really with everybody. You know, water comes from the mountains, it comes from the ground, it goes to our homes, it goes to treatment plants like ours. We clean it, it goes back in the rivers, it gets used again for drinking, for farming, for recreation, for aquatic life, you know, for all of those things that we value our river for. We are just one piece of that, and we want to make sure that we make decisions that are in harmony with the decisions that Denver Water makes or Aurora Water makes and Mile High Flood District makes. So we're providing the same benefits and not crossing paths with those other entities in a way that's not the best investment for our folks that we work with. So we have great relationships with all of these other entities in the water sphere, and we're really proud of that, and that's something we're going to continue to work on, and we think that has brought a lot of value to our communities. So that was a lot fast, but I want to make sure you had time for questions. But that's who we are and what we do, and I am more than happy and hopeful that you have questions for me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. Before we go into questions, I want to welcome Councilman Hines, Council President Sandoval to the meeting as well. We'll start with Council Member Alvidres.
Thank you, Committee Chair. Thank you so much for that breakdown of a very important and complex topic. Something that stuck with me, definitely grateful for the removal of phosphorus. What other things should we be watching for, and are we testing the water afterwards as it goes into the river and the health of the river at that point to see what other contaminants, heavy metals, could be troubling our river?
Yeah, absolutely. We test literally hundreds of contaminants, including heavy metals, including arsenic, including phosphorus, nitrogen. A whole suite of things show up in our permit that are required from CDPHE. We generally don't have a lot of problems with those. They're at pretty low levels, a lot of those metals and things like that. They're low levels when they come in, and we're able to mostly deal with them as they go through our process. But those are things that are, it's very important that rivers not have those in them. So we are, you know, meeting those criteria. Those are also on the CDPHE roadmap. Will probably be even stricter limits in the future on those. And so, again, that's part of trying to keep those things out of the wastewater stream in the beginning. Ultimately, is better value for the community than having us do the cleanup. But those are part of literally hundreds of things that we monitor for on a daily basis.
That's helpful. And I think one of the things that has always troubled me, or that I've thought about, is when people use things like Drano or other chemicals down their systems. And so I'm curious, is that part of your cleaning process? So literally the water that you receive has, you know, human waste.
Yeah.
It has chemicals like Drano, bleach,
yeah,
chemicals people use to clean their homes, and
yes,
you're able to remove all of that.
Most of the chemicals, and I'm going to speak on a very general level here, so don't pin me down this. Most of the chemicals that you use in your home actually degrade during the process, sort of naturally, in their interactions with all the different parts of our system. But what we don't know is we don't know all the chemicals that are in those things. And we're, like I said before, the detection, our ability to detect chemicals has skyrocketed in terms of technology. And now we're finding there are things in there that we don't know a whole lot about. We don't know how dangerous they might be. So there's a lot of work being done by EPA, CDPHE, and the utilities on things that we're starting to find. But generally speaking, most of those chemicals, like bleach, for example, does literally sort of break apart in terms of something that PFAS does not do. Like PFAS stays together, the fluorine bonds in PFAS.
What about like Drano?
Drano, I think, is, I have to look at that specifically, okay. But I'm pretty sure that's one of the suite of like household cleaning products that generally dissipates.
Wow, that's good to know. It's a very scary product when you read the labels.
And it is. Yeah.
I'm glad to know that it does do that. And when you talk about those future investments and those capital projects, I'm curious, what are you talking about? Like, are they things along the river? Is it just one facility? What are you talking about?
Yeah, great question. So they are kind of everything. There's quite a bit of work that needs to be done in the interceptor system to make sure that the pipes that carry this stuff are safe and are going to be operable. So we have work to be done, you know, under the streets. But the big thing we have to do is what's called a tertiary system. So that's I showed you the primary clarifiers, the secondary, which is the biological nutrient removal. And then the third part is disinfection. That's not considered a third treatment. Third treatment will be essentially filtration, and it will produce an effluent that is close to drinking water quality.
Wow.
That investment, which hopefully, if we size it right and work it right, may be able to deal with things like PFAS, is upwards of $1 billion by itself. And so one thing we don't want to do is build it without knowing exactly how it's going to fit into everything else and the regulatory requirements. So we're working very closely with the CDPHE on the kind of timing of building that, which will be likely in the next decade. But that's a big chunk of it right there.
Great. And where you're reintroducing the water to the river, is there one location that you're mostly doing that? Is it outside of the municipalities? Is it in the middle? Like, where is that happening?
So at the Height plant, it is right on, I want to say, like 64th Street. It's in Commerce City. It goes right into the river there. At the plant in Brighton, it's just right on the Weld County line, I think, is where the discharge is. So, yeah, it's one discharge point. There are two kind of waterfalls that cascade, so it aerates and oxygen gets in, but that's where they get discharged into the river.
Okay, so that clean river water doesn't benefit like recreation or the water quality here in the city.
It's downstream, yeah.
Right, okay.
That's right.
And I'm curious, how is the community engaged in knowing about you all? How are they know like what they need to be watching with, microplastics and PFAS? And how do they, I think knowing about this will help if and when the bond were to come to our residents. Right. And so I'm curious, what kind of community engagement have you all done and are you planning to do in the future?
Yes, that's such a great question. And maybe 20 years ago, wastewater plants did not want anyone to know who they were. The idea was, if it wasn't the newspaper, it's good. We're doing our job. We're keeping our heads down. That has changed dramatically because of the costs and because of the impact that we have in our communities. They have to know more about what we do. So in the last, I want to say 5 years, probably a little before that, we have had started a concerted effort to engage with our communities. Our first focus is really the neighborhoods right around our plants because they're most impacted by air emissions, they're most impacted by the water, and by our traffic. We have truck traffic. But we also want to convince those communities that we're a good place to work and a good neighbor. So we're spending a lot of time locally, it's basically the North Denver communities on that side, Commerce City, with educating people on what we do, opportunities they can come and see things, see the plant, see how it's working, opportunities for employment. So that's one thing that we've been really focusing on. We've also been focusing on a social media presence, and my kids could tell you more about that than I can, but it seems to be working. We've really grown in social media, and it's really exciting because there are a lot of these technological things that we do that are actually really cool, and we want people to know about them. And
the
also,
ambient loop alone, I think that would make many Denverites proud of our city, and messaging around that and educating our community, that's something that we're working on, I think, is valuable.
Yeah, the mayor is a big supporter of this. We're working with staff right now on it. The governor has been a big supporter. There's a lot of pieces to move around, but I think, yes, I agree. It's so exciting.
I appreciate that. And the last thing that I'll say, and then one last question, is I know cost has come up, and I do think about access to water. And I think it's very scary to talk about the cost of water when people need it to survive. Yes. It's one of the most basic things that we all need to survive. So I just wanted to say that when we talk about the cost of business, obviously we have to be responsible with our relative, the river, and making sure we're being responsible with our water usage. But there was one thing on here around environmental solutions and where our water goes from here, how or who isn't, maybe not, it may not be your area of expertise or what you all do, but how are we making sure that that water is at the level that it needs to be when it's leaving? And are we looking into any technologies to prevent evaporation of that water with global warming?
Yeah, so great, great questions. The cost issue is, you know, a central focus, like I said, of our board, obviously. One of the things that we are concerned about is there was a federal support for like a LIHWAP program, which is making sure that people at or near the poverty line would have water regardless of. And I am involved in a bunch of national committees, including the president of what's called NACWA, which is the National Association of the Clean Water Agencies. And we lobbied for a permanent LIHWAP for anybody who couldn't pay their water bill to have help. The current administration is not, responding to that, not too surprisingly, but we are not giving up on that. So that would be help for the cities and the counties, and a lot of rural communities have problems with this. So we're working on that end of it. We are also looking for any grant money that's available, any funding is available. But on the federal side, again, that's, not as plentiful as it was before. In terms of, what we discharge into the river, of course, we monitor that personally every day, and then we turn in a report to CPHE. So we know when it leaves the river, it's in very good shape. What happens in urban waterways, though, is that there are a lot of interactions with the waterway that have nothing to do with wastewater discharge. There are people that dump things into the rivers. There are runoff from streets, which is often very difficult to control. And other things, animal waste, too, is a large one as well. So, the water is going to be subject to pollutants in an urban corridor like this. We understand that. We've done work in the river downstream from where we are to ensure river health and aquatic life health. We've invested millions in that. But ultimately, things like controlling stormwater, which is a longer-term issue for municipalities, is going to be very expensive, but I think ultimately really beneficial for the environment, is probably the next answer for that. Interestingly, though, the people who own the water that go through Metro is chiefly Denver. Denver Water owns most of the water. Aurora Water owns a big chunk of it, and some local water companies. So the water rights themselves are held by those companies, those entities, and they are very jealous of evaporation. So they make sure that we stay on top of that because they don't want to lose that water. But once it's in the river, they've got to either use it or it will go down the river and it could evaporate as well. So shade tree planting along the river, those types of things are really ultimately great ideas for keeping the river cool and limiting evaporation.
Thank you so much for indulging all my questions. Thank you so much. Committee Chair.
Thank you. Councilwoman Gilmore.
Thank you, Committee Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. I had to look up to make sure we used to, I ran an environmental education science-based nonprofit, and we'd always take students. We were at Colorado Parks and Wildlife up off of Broadway. So we would always go in May or June to go tour the plant and everything. And I wonder about, first, thank you for all the work that you're doing. And how do you do outreach and education to the broader community? I think back, wrote an environmental justice EPA grant to teach youth and families about point source and non-point source pollution. And as you're talking about, animal waste, a lot of people think that they save money by washing their car in their driveway or on the street, but actually they use way more water. And then all of the oil, the salt, all of the pollutants are then pushed into the stormwater drains and have to go through your plant and then are discharged into the river instead of going to a car wash. And actually that water going down that drain and it goes right to you and is cleaned. And so kind of some of the pieces how do you get education out to folks, especially with the close proximity of Suncor and the concern about
our favorite
pollutants?
That's a great question. So in part of our community engagement program involves an education program that we have a couple of dedicated staff that work on. At our plant in Brighton, we have an education center that has maps of how the sewer system works. It shows different elements of the aquatic life that interact. It talks about all the different processes of wastewater. We take junior high, high school groups up there all the time. We take junior high and high school groups on tours of our plant all the time. I said the bigger plant in the Denver, Commerce City border there. And we are now in. We have one program established at Arvada High and establishing other programs with some other water providers in high schools around the region to talk about, one, how it all works and why it's beneficial, and two, what your career track could be if you're interested in it. So, you know, our limitation there is just what everyone's is, just resource. If we could have 10 people do it, we would do more, but we have to be judicious. But it's always pays off. I just wish we could do more of it. So we're just continuing to try to find what can expand reach. Social media has helped with that. It's really helped connect with that level of, you know, that age group of people. So that's been really cool. And we're finding people coming back from our education sessions who ask for jobs, come back, want to work with us, tell us that they supported something that, you know, was up on social media. So we have interns who come back, they say, I went on a tour and I wanted to work here. So it's really cool. But one thing I do want to note, because I think this is important, we don't receive stormwater at Metro.
That's right.
I
was
going to
correct
yeah.
myself. I was like, it's been a while since I taught that education course.
Right. But
yeah,
so that's even
that's
worse in a way because that goes
because
right
it goes
into
right
the river.
In.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, and, you know, having family that lives out on the Northeastern Plains, and when you think about the South Platte, that is really the drinking water for thousands and thousands of folks. And so how do you, or how are you responsible for, or if you aren't, who is, to monitor kind of changes in usage mm-hmm. in the city? If, you know, now we'll probably have a higher usage because we've had a series of hotter days and just tracking that, I guess, so there maybe isn't some anomaly or leak or something that we wouldn't be aware of.
Yeah, that another great question. So we are in two, Denver Water, Aurora Water, and a bunch of smaller water providers are our source. And so we're very closely aligned with what they're doing. We understand what their usage patterns are, and we talk to them about that. We also meter and sample what comes into our system, so we know exactly how much water is coming at any given time. I don't know exactly. The metering is more continuous. The sampling is the strength or the stuff in the wastewater. So we're very aware of that. Our systems are pretty airtight, not completely. You can imagine, you know, hundreds of miles of pipes, you're going to have some leaks. Local systems are a little less well-funded, and so the local communities have a little harder time with INI, which is infiltration and inflow. But we, you know, we help them, you know, work with their systems and try to identify those sources. You know, a lot of the water that gets used in the summer is going into the storm drain, though, because it's going to lawns and it's going outside, so it's not coming to us. But we do get concerned about increase in flow, mostly just because the constituents in the flow are harder to deal with. The actual flow itself, though, this is a fascinating thing. So we built our system, you know, in the late, well, we built it in the 60s, but we really started monitoring overall community flow, I think, with some accurate measurements in the early 70s. And we are getting about the same amount of water now as we got in the early 70s. And it's because of how well we have done with water conservation. You know, through the construction codes, through people's habits, it's really incredible. So we've got very big pipes that can handle, if we get a lot of flow, we can handle it. We're not at risk of overflows, mostly because the cities and counties have done such a good job. And that's something I think doesn't get celebrated enough in terms of...
Oh my, that's a huge, I'm just like, the 70s, that's amazing. That
now, whether there's overall more water use because of watering lawns and things like that, that's not coming to us, that's a Denver water question or an Aurora water question, but certainly what we're seeing is very consistent.
Wow. Huh. Yeah. That is really interesting. And then around... listening to climate scientists and, you know, the upper basin and the lower basin, and really the concerns about flow for the lower basins, especially as we see hotter days and less snowpack. Yeah. Up on the mountains. Is there any group in the Denver Metro or Front Range area that are looking to overlay Western science with indigenous knowledge or practices? And I ask you this question because I was at a seminar with a climate scientist from Arizona State, right, and like had all the climate models, and it's either going to get really, really hot, yeah, and we won't be able to grow anything, or it will get more tropical, moist, and we'll have a period of maybe 15 years to try to reverse course again. But is there any groups that are looking at this in that way?
You know, so we're on the wastewater side. We're not providing the drinking water, and the source is not as important to us in terms of we don't have to make sure we've got enough water. We just get it. But that being said, we work very closely with water providers on reuse now, because that's going to be kind of the next. They're going to use water directly out of our plant once we build tertiary. And they should, because it's going to be almost perfectly safe drinking water. But somebody from Denver Water or Aurora Water would be better suited to answer that. But my guess is there's a lot of open minds in those groups, a lot of really innovative people who are thinking, you know, about a very difficult problem to solve. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're considering all kind of areas of, you know, information.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Councilman Watson, and then Hines on deck.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And I find this to be such an interesting discussion. Councilwoman Alvidres stole my question on the ambient loop. I never really considered wastewater in your role. We really talked a lot about Xcel Energy's chilled water systems and steam systems, yeah, as part of that process, and how we're going to maybe the pilot that the state of Colorado is now, I think, Castor won the opportunity for that pilot to look at leveraging those that heating and cooling process, yeah, to power municipal buildings, throughout the downtown and maybe other buildings. So really didn't have a sense of where wastewater was with the ambient loop, but I think is a fantastic opportunity and innovation. My question is specific to kind of the innovative process on National Western and my curiosity around future development. This is South Platte committee, and so my question would be on, like, for example, Ball Arena. And when you're looking at River Mile and that combined massive new city that's being proposed to be built, as we're thinking of innovation and lessons learned from what National Western is doing for thermal heating and managing that, is there a proactive discussion with large developments like that right right next to our the Platte River? Are there proactive discussions about leveraging some of that innovation as part of the ways in which we're being energy forward thinking, or are those things that the developer or development group has to come to you on? I mean, how do we interact and intersect on ensuring that that innovation isn't just something that's left out there, and then they build our systems based on current technology, but not based on innovative technologies like what we're doing at National Western?
That's a great question. The answer is kind of all of the above. We have been speaking with both those developments and the project teams that are working on the, you know, design phase and the conception phase, mm-hmm, for a while now, and had, you know, offered up these ideas in terms of, you know, innovative solutions that could help offset, you know, energy use and offset water use as well. So we've been involved in those discussions. They are, you know, I would say they're just at an early place in the evolution, but the information's there. They understand what we see this technology as being able to do. There are installations in Europe that are fairly large and very successful and very established. So it's not, I wouldn't call it cutting edge. Yeah. Developers kind of want to see a prove out scenario, and they're seeing it. So that would be part of a larger plan. Yeah, I mean, you've got the ambient loop, you've got these big developments. If we could offload and power all that stuff, it would just be such a win for all of us.
And I think it'll be a loss if we don't. And so my curiosity and question for you, yeah, and obviously to committee chair, is that as they're moving through that process, that we kind of integrate that as part of our discussion. It's not part of the criteria for approving development, but I think you have this outplat committee, and I think instead of having a reactive response to an energy forward thinking, that we maybe continue to have this dialogue in ensuring, as River Mile and Ball Arena now are all now one, they're kind of pulling all of the decisioning together,
yeah,
that we really have a proactive discussion as to the opportunity to do something different. And I'll close with one comment. I think the really complex water compacts that we have for downstream flow of water from Denver Water, from Colorado River to all of the lower basin states, I think there's lots of discussions on evaporation, how those water systems are used, the lower amount of snow melt and stuff. And so I think all of those impact the discussion we're having that Councilmember Alvarez brought forward about evaporation. Yeah. So it's not only simply Denver Water, Aurora, and others. We have some of the most complex compacts and contracts that may be administration proof as far as the ability to change some of those things. And so I think there are protections based on some of the questions we've been asking as far as water use within those compacts that actually can be leveraged with some of the good work that wastewater is doing and the good work that Denver Water and Aurora Water and others are doing as well. So just wanted to make a quick comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I appreciate all those comments.
Thank you, Councilman Hines and Council President on deck.
Thank you, Council Torres. Thank you for the presentation. We get to consider things that I guess people probably often would say is unsexy, and
yeah, I get it. I understand.
You do something with them, and so no. I mean, I think it's like, you know, those of us who were crazy enough to seek public office and allow our private life, open it for public inspection. You know, we're a different breed of creature, I think, and so I think this, is just really an exciting conversation, an exciting topic. Helps that my mom's a hippie, so how do we minimize our impact on the planet? Mm-hmm. How do we use the planet? So kind of to Councilmember Gilmore's point about indigenous community, how do we leave as light a touch and as little trace as possible? Yep. And some of that we can do a lot of work as individuals. Some we've really got to lean on the companies that are creating these things that have chemicals that we don't really think about when we're throwing something in the trash, we're washing our car in the in the street instead of going to a car wash. I'm very excited about the steam loop modification. I represent downtown. Steam loop, I think, would make a whole lot of sense. And to Councilmember Watson's point, I was thinking of it from an electricity standpoint, yeah, not as much of a reclamation standpoint. So that's that's really, now I'm even more interested in it.
Yeah.
Thanks for pointing out that Denver has some membership on your board. I went to your website. I saw the members. I recognize some of the names, including former Councilmember Sussman, and some of the names I don't recognize. I'm curious, how are they appointed? Are they all mayoral appointees? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Just file that away for another conversation at another time. I hadn't really had the opportunity to ask someone who might be a subject matter expert about this, but, just 5 or 7 years ago, the General Assembly gave Coloradans the opportunity to collect a rain barrel's worth of water, whereas before we could not collect any water.
Right.
So again, minimizing our impact and treading as lightly as possible. So I think we now can collect, we as in the people in Colorado can collect one rain barrel's worth of water. Is that Is that
yeah, that's again, that's on the sort of the drinking water side, but I think that's correct, yes.
Yeah, well, and instead of having that just kind of go down the, right. The chain and...
huge advantage, yeah.
Yeah, and if we can keep that water and use it internally for plants or, yeah. You know, but, so this might be closer to your wheelhouse. I believe that the state of New Mexico allows residents to use reclaimed water in the house. I believe the state of Colorado does not. As in, say you've got a kitchen sink, you know, you wash your hands, that water, I believe in the state of Colorado, you have to drain it out of the home. Whereas in the state of New Mexico, the drain of that sink can go to a plant bed.
Right.
Or you know, or something. Is that? Do you know any? Is that your?
Yeah, that's my understanding. There are gray water regulations in some states that allow for different uses of previously used water. Colorado's considered it. I don't think it's off the table entirely with CDPHE for in terms of you know water quantity issues. So I think it's something that they've in the reuse regulation process they talked about. I'm not familiar with kind of where they are on that right now. But, you know, any way we can save water is a good way, you know, as long as it keeps people safe. I mean, you don't want to reuse certain types of water that can cause health problems, obviously. But we would be in favor of anything that saves water, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thought is that there's drinking water, there's water, there's gray water and brown water. Yeah. And so brown water, something that you wouldn't want to drink. You wouldn't want to use your plants that should exit the system. And frankly, in the you know the, there's home kind of solutions. You know, when you build a home, that sounds similar to your process. You've got bigger things that you know more microbial kind of processing than an individual home would have. But then you know the gray water. If you wash your hands in the sink, or you know, as long as you are conscious of the kind of dish soap that you use, then that could go into plants. And then frankly, that makes us as consumers more aware of the kind of water that we're using. And we think about, you know, actually I do want to get a better kind of soap because my plant will die if I use Drano or bleach, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, I didn't know if that was something that was that, you know, that you or you know the organization was considering, you know. But I'm happy to reach out to CDPHE. It just seems like if we do have people who are interested in creating homes that recycle, reuse, you know, as opposed to making it, you know, just because that would be less for you to treat, right?
It would be.
Yeah. And so anyway, okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, President Sandoval.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I enjoyed our tour. I really learned a lot. I was out there with my staff and sparked lots of thoughts, especially when we were having conversations about the ambient loop and how complicated it is and how we're using the model of the National Western Center to make sure that we're doing that. But it's going to take you all helping us and lots of other partners.
Yeah.
My one question that as somebody who really fought to have accessory dwelling units, you're the one, I think that people don't quite understand that when we get a fee associated with accessory dwelling units, it comes from you all. There's a tap fee, but there's also another fee that comes that's set by you all. Can you just explain to my colleagues that it's not just for Denver, that that fee that's associated with the accessory dwelling unit is actually other jurisdictions that because we when I was there, one of my questions was like, can we change that fee so that we can have it be less expensive to do these? And it's a little bit more complicated than you just changing that fee because there's other jurisdictions involved.
So actually, a little bit of a preview of something that should be happening this fall is we are going to change that. Currently, the way it's written is vague. It doesn't say that you have to charge for an ADU. It just can be interpreted that way and has been interpreted that way by some of our connectors. Mm-hmm. the clarity that we're bringing to that now is we will not require an additional fee unless there's a separate new water tap. So if you're using the same water tap on the property and you're just splitting off, you know, a mother-in-law apartment or a separate little dwelling, still using the same tap, Metro would not charge an additional tap. The communities, because we charge that to Denver, Denver could charge it if it wants to, doesn't have to if it doesn't want to. So that's going to hopefully resolve the clarity issue there in terms of ADUs. But that should be approved in September.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think that's something that can you take back to whoever is your governmental affairs person and ask them? Yeah.
She's thank right
you.
Here.
Good to see you. Can you produce a newsletter blurb for all of our city council offices? Because
sure.
I think that would be, given now that accessory dwelling units are citywide, that would be something instead of me having to say, hey, we've been talking about that because my council aide, we dug into that and it took me a while to figure out where those fees were coming from. And once I figured them out, you know, I stopped you and I did the tour. So it'd be really helpful if we could make that announcement through all 13 of our council offices. So people understood A, how the structure changed, A, the rule change, and B, what the new fee would be and how that could impact their capital stack for an accessory dwelling unit would be super helpful.
Yeah, well, that's a great idea. And that's probably, we're making a number of changes to the rules, but that's probably the one that people would be most connected to.
Yeah,
so I think that's great.
Especially in Denver, now that we have it citywide, I think all of us would be excited to hear that. So anytime after the rule change, if you just sent us a blurb, we would add it to our newsletter so that it makes it more public.
Yeah, we can do that for sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Perfect. Thank you. Really great questions. I know I even heard from my state senator, Senator Julie Gonzalez, who did a tour of the location, and she was just in awe at the operation that you have at your facility. And so thank you so much for being here. This is one of the entire purposes of creating this special interest committee, really focused on the river and what's happening all along its banks. So thank you so much for being our partner and agent of this great work. And thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
With that, we're adjourned. Thanks everyone.
That's great.